I would like to call this meeting of the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy to order. Can we please be seated? Okay, there is a quorum.
Really? Wow.
May I have a motion to approve the minutes? Thank you. Representative Leveland has moved approval of the minutes for Tuesday, January the 29th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for Tuesday, January 29th are approved. So we have a bill before us today, but before we get to that bill, I would just like to say that this bill on opiate is a huge bill. It's a pretty comprehensive bill that has been vetted, that has the support not only of this legislative body, but also from the community. There is a crisis that is going on within our communities across the state of Minnesota. And I am so happy and delighted to know that this is a bipartisan bill that's going to be moving through this body. It's going to be introduced bipartisanly, which is really, really important. And as the chair of this committee, my intention is to move this bill before us today. That is the intent. We have testifiers that have traveled from across the state of Minnesota to be here to share their testimony, and I want to make sure that we are able to do just that. And so it's really important that I allow that to happen, and that we create sufficient time for each speaker to speak. So one of the things that we have done ahead of time is just said to our testifiers to come before us to the table, be really clear in your statement about what you need to say, because we want to really make sure that we allow everyone to have a voice who have come before us to do that. So we'd like to give you a few minutes to do that. Let's see. One of the things that I would like to state is that my intent, again, is to move this bill today. If we do not get through by 4:15, we will return this afternoon at 5:15 to complete the bill before us. I am going to put a priority for the testifiers to speak today. I want everyone, the members here around the table, and also in the audience, to know that I like to be fair. I like to be a good listener and to create a space for people to come before this body to discuss and share their thoughts on this bill. But I'm also a chair that wants to be effective. And my first priority is to allow the members who travel from around the state to have their voices heard. And so we won't spend too much time today with opening statements from members, because as we can all see, community showed up. So what I would like to do is bring the bill before the committee. So I would like to move House File 400. Representative Olson and Representative Baker to come before me. And I would like to move House File 400 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee of Commerce. We have the bill before us. Representative Olson, I'd like to welcome you to the committee today. I understand that there are some author's amendment. Do you wish to say anything to the amendments before we take action?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thanks to everybody for being here, and thank you to Representative Baker for being at the table as we go through this bill today. Before I make comments on the bill and walk through, I do want to move the author's amendment, and I would also move to accept there are two amendments to the amendment that are also on the table, that are also here today, and I would move to accept those amendments into the author's amendment as well.
Representative Olson, what would be those?
I can't move those, but I would ask that we consider the amendments to the amendments along with the author's amendment.
Okay. Okay. Representative Pinto.
And Madam Chair, I'm happy to move that we adopt the author's amendment incorporating the language of the A3 and A4 amendments to the amendments. It sounds like that's something we'll be author to get the bill in the manner in the language that that the author wishes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. So Representative Pinto moves that the A1, which is the author amendments, incorporating the A3 and the A4 amendments to the amendments, be incorporated. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The A1 amendment as amended is adopted. Representative Olson, to your
Madam
bill.
Chair, isn't it customary to actually open that up for discussion as well on those amendments?
Are you requesting to?
No.
I'm actually a point of parliamentary inquiry, I guess.
So, Representative Pearson, one of the things that I really would like to do, so let me just give a little history here, right? So yesterday we went through this long conversation about the amendments, where I created a space to allow the amendments, not only amendments to the amendments, to have an opportunity to be presented in this committee, and that was done. We had this huge conversation yesterday about creating a place where the community can travel down from the rural community to have a voice to be heard, you know. And I welcome that discussion. I think I created, you know, a great space to have those conversations to happen. And so what just happened is that the opportunity that I presented for the minority community to do as they asked to do happened. We have the author of the bill who had decided to accept two of the amendments onto our bill. And what I would like to do, Representative Pearson, is I would like to allow the author of the bill, the authors of the bill, to have an opportunity to discuss the bill. And we will move to a space where we can discuss, you know, you can ask questions. That would take place.
Well, Madam Chair, again, I actually agree with you 100%. You've done a great job of facilitating these conversations, and you know, well done yesterday. Outstanding. Outside of that, my deeper question goes to yesterday, you stating there were 20 people on our speakers list today. And today there are 14 people on the speakers list. And the first time I raised my hand here this afternoon, I wasn't addressed and we were introducing the bill. Because I simply wanted to ask the question, because clearly you want to move this today. You've stated that a couple of times, and I appreciate and respect that position. My question is, who were the other six testifiers and why were they not able to be here today?
Nicole? See the weather?
So the question that you put before me is what happened to the other six testifiers who are not on the list. So what we have allowed testifiers to do, as we always do, for those who decide that it's best for them to submit a written testimony, for those who could not make it, they decided to do that. And why they didn't, I mean, you know, family gets in the way. And there's many different reasons why, you know, people can't. But again, we have the testimonies in our folder.
And Madam Chair, again, I'm all for hearing testimony of everyone that was able to make it here today. Just outstanding. And the question actually goes to why we aren't already talking about holding over the bill so we can hear from everyone. We already know that this bill was introduced extremely late. And the notice for the communities, all communities to participate on a day like today, for the reasons that audience members pointed out, it was very difficult to get here today. And I just would continue this conversation is so important, and I don't want to take up a lot of time, but this conversation is so important that I don't understand why our request to hold over this bill can't be recognized and accepted so that everyone can have input on this bill and the multiple amendments that shifted and changed, you know, within a couple of hours of this hearing. So I would respectfully request that in advance so that we don't have to rush anyone, so that we can listen to all of the people who were able to come here today and we can continue the conversation. Again, I understand the objective, but I don't think it serves the bill well.
But thank you, Representative Pearson, for that statement. And like you, and like the members around the table, you know, we really appreciate those who have traveled here, those who are here now, and we're going to respect the fact that they are here and create enough space in this hearing today so that we can acknowledge that at this moment. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think the issue that we are addressing today is nonpartisan in nature. And the focal point of this conversation, however long it takes, are the people that suffer from such a dread disease. And so as I look at the testifiers lineup, the committee structure, and what we are called to do, I think it would be incumbent upon us, and I think you share this, that for the next hour and a half or however long it takes until 4:15, I think we should avail the people in the audience to have the opportunity to speak to us from their hearts, and speak to us from their personal experiences, and then commit ourselves to coming back at 5:15 and taking up the committee structure that we know about the amendments, and have a robust conversation for however long it takes then, but for the interest of public safety, with the roads and with the weather being it is, I think that it would be a disservice to the folks if we didn't allow them as much time during this afternoon before it gets dark to say their piece and inform us about, you know, how this this issue affects them. So you have our commitment that we want to have the conversation, but we'd like to have it so that all participants have an opportunity to speak to our committee. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And I appreciate that, Representative Albright. So let's move the bill to the bill. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think it's fitting that we're here today on a very cold day. This discussion is not new today. There are a lot of folks who have come before us, including Representative Baker and many in this room who have worked for a long time. For my colleagues that are asking for more time, I would just remind folks that even the amendments you are offering are part of a bill that was in your control last year, and we are here again today. So there is urgency. One of the testifiers that cannot be here today is Lieutenant Jeff Kazel from the Duluth Police Department, and the reason he can't be here is because he is fighting this crisis back home. There is urgency that we all know from personal standpoints, from community standpoints. In my community in December, we saw the highest number of overdoses that we have ever seen due to the opioid crisis. Our folks know that every day that we don't act is a day that a life could be lost. And we ask everybody to come to the table, and I think this bill brings that forward. And so I think it's really fitting that we're here today and we're not waiting any longer to address a crisis that many of us in the room have felt on deeply personal levels. And from a state legislator perspective, we're asked to act. The public is asking for us to act because this is a crisis that we're facing from our state budget perspective. It's costing our counties. It is costing every taxpayer in this room. With every day of inaction we have, this costs us more and more in personal and financial losses. And so today is a new day, and we're bringing forward a great piece of legislation that is at stop number one. This will take several stops along the way. I have no belief that this is the perfect piece of legislation out of the gate, but I'm committed to working with folks here around the table, from folks on both sides of the aisle, to make sure that we continue to work together to do a bipartisan effort to incorporate as many voices as we can into this bill. So with that, I will get into the bill, and I will also be turning over to Representative Baker in a minute to share some comments as well. So to the bill in front of us, as amended, what we've put forward is a bill that is going to be looking to generate revenue from a registration fee for manufacturers and distributors. So you'll see that in the first part of the bill. We're going to be asking an advisory council to form with the various stakeholders to then look over the funds that will go into a special account to be able to figure out how we administer these. Through this bill, we'll also be looking at how we go upstream and continue to keep this crisis from happening through prevention and education efforts. We are going to be having grant funding for various departments and commissioners to work in close contact with the advisory council so that we're talking about existing prevention methods that we know work. We're talking about looking at innovative new methods of what we'll do to address this crisis. And a particular part I'm excited about that you see reflected in the amendment that we just put forward today. For those of you that were at last Friday, we had the opportunity to go to Mille Lacs, and we had the opportunity to hear from tribal governments, which are some of the tribal leaders and tribal representatives who, and we know tribal communities are some of the hardest hit by this crisis. And so we've added in language to reflect what we heard on Friday to be able to offer these funds to culturally sensitive and culturally appropriate programming in those areas as well, which I'm incredibly proud. And I think this bill really gets to the spirit of holding accountable that which needs to be held accountable and providing culturally appropriate, innovative and proven ways to fight this crisis through education, prevention, and treatment. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Baker.
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair and Committee, thank you for allowing us to have the bill here today. I just want to make a very quick statement because we want to get to the testifiers as well. I have worked on this bill or like this bill for a long time. I also want to thank a lot of the members that are sitting at this table and folks that are not here at the table that have helped us write this bill. Representative Albright worked a lot of stuff on this bill with federally qualified health care centers that can do a lot of great work. Representative Kresha did some great work in Morrison County with that is currently spawning more medical centers that are providing naloxone and also suboxone support for people that are in full-blown addiction, and it's amazing results. The ECHO project is going really well from the folks in Morrison County. Representative Kunish Padin helped me write the Jake's Law education system in this bill, and components of that are straight in this bill. There are a lot of really good things in this bill, and a lot of members have responsibility and should take great pride in where this bill is at. As Representative Olson has said, we do not have this bill right yet, and we have a lot of places to make it better. I am committed to doing that, and I allow our testifiers to tell us their story. With a 55 low wind chill, I can't imagine a better day to do this right now to warm the hearts of what we have to hear. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it back to you.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Olson.
I also, to the point I made about the visit to the Mille Lacs, they weren't able to be here but did want to send a letter of support for the bill in the language we're including today.
That's great. Thank you. So let's begin hearing testimony. So, and again, you know, as you come up, please introduce yourself. I am notorious for, you know, trying to pronounce names. So if I don't, we really need you to say your name and be really clear and as concise as you can be. So the first testifier will be Charles Ritznikoff. Can we also have Shelley Elkington? Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Charles Ritznikoff. I'm an addiction medicine and an internal medicine doctor at Hennepin Healthcare and in Rice County, Minnesota. Okay. Shall I begin?
Yes, please.
Okay. I just want to start by thanking you all for considering this Bill, and also for your work for Minnesota. I have a few brief comments about opioid addiction and what opioid addiction is in some ways to understand it and the work that I've been doing with opioid addiction. All addictions, of course, are cut from similar fabric, but each addiction is unique in some ways. Opioid addiction is unique in its lethality. Opioid addiction kills people at any age of life and has a very high death rate. So recent evidence shows that if you have an opioid addiction, your chance of death is 25% in 10 years, and that's comparable to having bad colon cancer. So it's a very serious diagnosis to get for someone. If you've had an overdose and survived, your death rate doubles, 5% per year. And if you have just come out of a long period of abstinence and then you have your first relapse, your death rate is 20-fold as high. And we know that, for example, from our incarcerated populations, in the first 2 weeks after release from incarceration, their death rate from overdose is 20 times as high. So it's a very serious, grave mortality number for people with opioid use disorder. What do we do about it? Well, I think it's important when you think about interventions, you ask not just what sounds good or what looks good or what feels good, but how do we know it? How do we know that that helps people, and what are the outcomes? So medications, and this is part of what I do, methadone or buprenorphine, some people call buprenorphine Suboxone, methadone or buprenorphine with hundreds of thousands of patients studied, lower death rate threefold. You lower death rate threefold while you're on it, but it's not a cure, and it's not an easy answer, and it has to be maintained long term. And we don't know how to get people off those medications or cure opioid addiction. But while you're on methadone or buprenorphine, your death rate is one-third, better pregnancy outcomes, less HIV and hepatitis C transmission, less incarceration, and less drug use. So there's a lot of good outcomes there. There are other medications such as naltrexone, which may be beneficial but is less well-researched. A few more final comments. And I can back this up, but I can say with relative certainty that the number of opioid addicts, people with opioid addiction, I should say, people with opioid addiction in Minnesota, 30,000 people, maybe as many as 50,000 people. And 85% of those folks are not treated. And if you think that means we have tens of thousands of Minnesotans that have a 10-year mortality of 25%. We will keep seeing that this death rate continue for decades, literally, until we identify those with an addiction and offer them complete treatment, full-service treatment, including lots of options that best fit them, their wishes, and their needs. So this is going to keep going. And if you look at Portugal or Ireland, England, Spain, France, they've all had successful interventions to lower the opioid overdose death rate. They've always incorporated medications, but it wasn't as simple as medications, and they've had really dramatic decreases in death rates. We're not those countries, obviously. We're going to do it our way. But I just wanted to let you all know that this has been done in other parts of the world successfully, and we can do it here.
Thank you.
The final comment I would just say is we don't have a cure yet, and we are hopeful that we can develop new cures. And to that extent, we really need industry to help us, because they need to develop new interventions, new medications, new treatments for both pain and for addiction. So industry is not our enemy. But I think in Minnesota we can say that if there's a business model that causes harm and is causing harm to the people of Minnesota, that business, whatever the industry is, should be accountable for some of the harm they're causing. And that could be true whether we're talking about 3M, or whether we're talking about a pharmaceutical industry, or whether we're talking about any industry. If you've got a business model that externalizes some harm to Minnesotans, we got to try to make you accountable while maintaining partnership. And so that's those are my remarks. I appreciate your time and attention. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Pearson?
Yeah, just a quick factual question. When we were in LAC, there was a
testimony that was given up there that talked about that, that treatment,
Suboxone.
Suboxone, yeah. Excuse me. You were talking about the decrease in mortality rates when that's prescribed. I'm assuming you're referring to a prescription with counseling then. Is that what that number is an indication of is the only question I have.
Mr.
Rezinov. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
I get it.
Yeah. Rezinov. The all of the studies include counseling because it should be the default that people get counseling in addition to their medications. And so all reputable, you couldn't ethically study addiction without providing counseling. Thank you.
Representative? Okay. All right, to the next testifier, please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Shelley Elkington. Madam Chair, thank you for acknowledging the people that have traveled. I drove almost 3 hours last night to come here, and it was treacherous, but it's important, and I knew I had to be here, so thank you for acknowledging that. It really was a tough drive. I lost my daughter, Casey Jo, at 26 years old, and I want to acknowledge people in this room that have lost their children. I want you all to know that I'm not just speaking about my daughter. I'm speaking about your son and yours. And yours, and your friends, and yours. So I just want to say that. And I would really like to see the bill moved forward. I've testified a number of times on this bill, and it's been a struggle. And I, too, would like to see things move forward today. We've came a long way, and we'd appreciate that. Casey Jo is 26 years old, and that's how old she will forever be. She was sick. She had a chronic and painful condition called Crohn's disease. As a result of complications, she was prescribed pretty high amounts of opioids for pain. For about 2 years, she was given oxycodone, oxycontin, fentanyl, along with some benzodiazepines. She took her prescriptions to the pharmacy in the clinic each appointment, and she was handed these killer medications like clockwork each and every month. These medications were given to her by a doctor. She was sick. She was going to be okay. We thought she was safe, but she wasn't. Casey Jo went from a champion swimmer, an athlete, a dancer, a student, to a shell of a human, to an addict. My heart broke each day seeing the life drain from her beautiful brown eyes, her dreams, her ambitions, her love of science and learning. They were all gone. Her day was consumed with her addiction. Getting more pills, going to the emergency room, being admitted to the hospitals. My days and nights were like many of the parents in this room, filled with uncertainty, anxiety, but most of all, fear. Our children died every day before they actually died, and that's a reality. Watching Casey Jo live with her addiction each day was nearly as hard as losing her to it. Would she be calling me for money, needing help? Would she be close to dying or overdosing? Would she be arrested? Would she be raped? Would she be killed? All of those things happened to my daughter. Our fears became reality. And that happens when our children are living a life that we cannot control, we cannot help, and we cannot change. The last day I ever saw Casey, I went with her to the doctor. I had called to tell him that I was concerned about her opioid use. But even more, I was afraid that he would stop giving them to her and she would turn to heroin. Little did I know that she already had. When we met with the doctor, her face was blank. She barely spoke. He told her that she needed to find a treatment center or he could not prescribe to her anymore. He gave her another month's worth, but that was it. There was no referral. There was no specialist assigned to her. There was no nurse making phone calls to help up an intake somewhere. There was no pamphlets handed out or a list of resources to call. Just, you need to find a treatment center. I watched what little hope was in her leave that day. In fact, she filled her prescriptions on her way out of the clinic. She went into a gas station bathroom, and she nearly overdosed. She lived to tell me that she was fine. I left her in a hotel room that night. I hugged her. I looked into her eyes, and I knew I would never see her alive again. 6 weeks later, we were called by the Fargo, North Dakota Police Department to tell us that her body had been found in her garage. When we identified her body, we were asked how over the phone. Her brown eyes, the tattoo she had. She wore glasses. They never asked us if we were Republicans. They never asked us if we were Democrats. They don't ask you those things. When I was at the press conference this morning, I watched four legislators from this body across the street get up together, and nobody asked them either. You couldn't tell. They didn't announce themselves as a Republican or a Democrat. They just got up to do the good work that we know we need to do. What I've taken from our loss is that I can't let Casey's voice be silenced. The fear she felt, the hopelessness she felt, the lack of any direction or support from her medical team, it has to change. No one should be given medications from a doctor to become addicted and then have the problem become their own to solve. This is a medical crisis that should be treated like one. Every patient should feel safe and comfortable telling their doctor they need help. Every patient should be given resources and immediate medical attention for withdrawal symptoms and addiction. Every patient should be treated with dignity and respect. Senator Rosen said at a press conference last week something that stuck with me. It said, we need to do this to help those that are still here. And she's right. She's absolutely right. I visit my daughter in a cemetery. There are mothers in our state right now that can be spared having to do that. There are mothers in the state that can see their daughters live. This legislation will prevent a mother from having to decide what plant to bring up to their daughter's grave each spring, because that's my reality. I'll leave you with one quote. Holding the powerful to account takes fearlessness, it takes tenacity, and it takes you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Chris Johnson and Rochelle Westland. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Dr. Chris Johnson. I'm an emergency medicine physician. I work for Alina Health. I serve on the board of the Rumler Hope Network, and I am chair of it.
That testimony didn't move you. You're heartless. That bill needs to go forward.
And I also chair the Department of Human Services Opioid Prescribing Workgroup. I want to thank Madam Chair and the members of the committee for this opportunity to speak today. And I also sort of want to apologize to members of the committee and to everyone here who's got patients and families who suffered from this crisis, because my profession failed you. Make no mistake, we are here listening to this testimony because the medical industry failed you. This crisis was not an accident. This was engineered. So I speak in support of this bill because you can't ignore the numbers that we're facing, not just in Minnesota, but around the country. In 1999, 6,000 Americans died of a combination of prescription and heroin overdose. In 2016, that was 50,000. That is not an accident. That is an agenda. It is important to understand why it happened and how it happened, because that's the study of epidemiology, and that is how we fix things, and that is why accountability is very important. And predominantly, almost exclusively, this was the creation of a pharmaceutical company agenda to sell opioids, not necessarily to create a holocaust of death, but they were trying to sell, and they found a compliant medical industry. And starting in 1996 with the introduction of OxyContin began a multi-million year marketing campaign that worked. Prescriptions quadrupled, billions in revenue were soon generated, and the deaths soared. And so we're here to help. We're here to ask the pharmaceutical industry to help fix the mess that it created. Among the things that always strikes me when I hear a testimony like Ms. Elkington's, of those, I mean, I know they're like, oh, the patients were demanding for medicines, but listen, the patients have almost no power in this marketplace, in the medical marketplace. If the patients had power in the medical marketplace, they wouldn't be paying triple the cost of insulin compared to what they did 10 years ago. They need us to act as advocates for them. They need you to act as advocates for them. And so one of the important things of this bill by generating fees is twofold. I hope that by generating these licensing fees from the pharmaceutical industry, we can help defray the cost of treatment for the patients and families that have suffered from this. Many have lost their fortunes and they're in financial ruin because of the cost of addiction, not just from the cost of treatment, but from jobs that are lost and all the other costs that go with it. And they need support. But the other important thing you can do by increasing the accountability on pharma is you can dissuade future marketing, which leads to overprescribing. And I couldn't think of a more fortuitous study to come out in the last 2 weeks than the one that just appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. You probably saw it in the New York Times. It drew a straight line from increased marketing and payments to doctors, but county by county, where there was increased marketing and payments to doctors, there was increased prescribing of opioids, and there was increased deaths. Period. So in adding this level of accountability, we are hoping to slow that chain reaction, and the fewer the patient, the less opioids the patient population is exposed to, the fewer overdose deaths there will be. I will conclude my statements this. Some of you might remember, I was here last year, and I actually began investigating this in 2005. I've been waving my hands frantically for 15 years now at my hospital and now at the state level. I wouldn't have believed I'd be doing it 15 years later, but here we are. I have to ask you as the legislators that because my profession has failed to look out for your constituents, I'm asking you to help us too. This is partly your responsibility, and we need to have everyone now accept that and begin turning this around, because the patients deserve better. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Before you start, can I have Suzanne Coppliger? Come down, please.
Here. Report.
Okay.
I'm good.
And okay. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm Hennepin County Commissioner Mike Opad, and I'm here representing Hennepin County and the Association of Minnesota Counties. Madam Chair and members, counties across the state support this legislation. We do that because we are neck deep in this crisis. Effects are felt across the state and evidenced in many of our systems and departments. Numerous factors contribute to substance use disorder, and we know fighting addiction in our communities must be rooted in a comprehensive approach. We appreciate that this bill invests needed funds into child protection. We have seen the impact of the opioid epidemic firsthand in Hennepin County as we try to reform our child protection and child well-being system. Some of these stats I'm going to give you are as compelling as I've seen in my more than 20-year career. We have seen a 96% increase in the number of child abuse and neglect cases involving opioids, 96%. 90% of child protection cases involving infants involve parental drug use, and heavy on that, of course, is opioids. In our hospital, and this one is probably the most compelling and tragic, in our hospital where we used to see 6 to 12 pregnant women in treatment for opioids per year, we are now seeing that same number on any given day. Of course, you can draw a bright line into child protection and out-of-home placements where in Hennepin County we are currently spending over $122 million a year. In other parts of our operations, we are now training our security officers to administer Narcan in our libraries. We've had overdoses in our libraries of all places. And countywide across our many buildings, our security officers are in a pilot project to make sure that Narcan is always at hand. This is a crisis that impacts the entire family. We recognize the opioid crisis has cost residents many things, as been mentioned, jobs, housing, employment, broken families, bankruptcies, adults in jails, number of children out of home care, and most importantly, loss of life. Last year in Hennepin County alone, we lost 149 residents to opioids. That is 149 too many. And as a tragic result of that, we have had increased costs to our medical examiner. We had a $400,000 increase in lab costs for synthetics testing. Two additional physicians were hired. and increased autopsy costs of $240,000 annually. We're also responding to our courts, jails, clinics, and, of course, emergency management services. So we need to focus on ending the crisis. This bill funds awareness and prevention programs to stop the crisis. Counties want to be a partner in this work. We appreciate that in the committee establishing this bill, there will be local representation. And so you can hear about our local challenges and strategies. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for bringing this bill forward.
And thank you both for your testimony. Could I have Suzanne and Jeff Bowles come to testify at our table? Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Suzanne Keplinger. I'm the director of the Catalyst Initiative at the Minneapolis Foundation. Shall I continue?
Please continue.
Okay. Catalyst Initiative has been investing for the last 4 years in building self-care as primary care and culturally meaningful trauma healing practices in community. And what we've found over the last 4 years is that these practices are very well received as a primary prevention strategy. So what I'm here to suggest is that all of the treatment and the recovery and the intervention programs are vitally important, and we specifically need more of all of that. But we should add on a true primary prevention piece, which goes to the heart of the matter. People are often using drugs and alcohol and taking their own lives because of their pain. It's either spiritual pain, emotional pain, physical pain. How do we get at the pain that people are suffering from and give them tools that may be able to help them use generative, positive, healthy practices? So we've been testing these models for a number of years, and we find they're very, very acceptable in community, and that there's a place for them in the continuum of care that we think should be offered as part of the strategy. We're talking about building resilience to address diseases of despair. And death by suicide, alcohol, drug addiction, these are diseases of despair. Resilience is one component, and resilience is a teachable skill. It's a set of practices that actually begin to go to the heart of how do you manage your pain? How do you deal with the traumas in your life? How do you counteract the effects of toxic stress in your community, for example? And like a new language, it has to be practiced. So what we're learning is that this is a very cost-effective intervention that teaches people the skills that they can use themselves and with their families and in their communities to actually cope with their pain and their trauma more effectively. It's not the panacea, but it should be part of the continuum of services that we're providing people. And access to non-narcotic pain management strategies. There's sufficient data now that shows that practices like yoga and mindfulness and therapeutic massage and meditation and acupuncture are truly effective in treating many types of physical pain. They should be accessible and available to people who need them. So we're particularly excited about the provisions in the bill that provide for a mapping study to help us understand where in the state of Minnesota do we actually have access to these resources, how effective are they, and what are the barriers to people accessing them, and then the support to do some demonstration projects to really begin to test some theories to say, when we go truly into a primary prevention stance, can we not only prevent diseases of despair, but what else could we do in helping people develop positive self-care that is their true primary care? We've got examples of this happening already. I'm happy to share those with you if you have those questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Can I have Margarita Ortega come down as Mr. Bauer testify?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Jeff Bauer with the Catalyst Initiative of the Minneapolis Foundation. I'll be very brief. Susanna said most of it. We really want to say thanks to Representative Olson and Representative Baker for putting this bill forward. You know, when you're in the midst of an epidemic, you have to intervene, and we're really pleased to see this bill happening at this time. We understand a lot of the interventions that need to happen right now are the acute variety, and we need to get on that immediately. We also know that prevention matters and that we haven't invested enough in prevention. And beyond that, we also know that oftentimes communities have their own solutions to these issues. And so we're really pleased to see so much language in this bill that references culturally specific, community-led interventions. You know, communities have their own means of healing, and we're just so pleased to see that supported in this bill. The other piece that we're particularly pleased to see is a position on the council reserved for someone who has direct lived experience of opioid addiction and treatment. We think that's vitally important to have that voice and many more of those voices building what the solution is. I'm just going to finish on a personal note, which I wasn't going to do, but it's actually when Suzanne asked me to work on this project, I'm a lobbyist. Yeah, I know a lot of you guys are like, hey, that's that lobbyist. He works on a lot of stuff. So I was obviously pleased to get a contract with Suzanne and the Minneapolis Foundation. But I also was pleased to be able to work on this issue because tomorrow is actually the 10-year anniversary of having lost my best friend to addiction. And so more than any issue I've worked on up here, this is a really personal one to me. And so I just want to thank you all so much for taking this up, taking it seriously, and making this the year that you get this done. Thank you very much.
Thank you both so much. And also I have Matt D. Laurento come down.
I just state my name.
Yes, please state your name, then you can continue with your testimony.
My name is Margarita Ortega. I am a jack of all trades, I want to say. I am a Little Earth resident. I am a member of Natives Against Heroin. I am also a policy pusher, and I also work with many city council members in the city of Minneapolis. I worked for council member Alondra Cano. I've done a lot of different things to help address this one issue, to try and combat it, but now it's time that the state help us. We can't continue to do this alone. We need your support as well. It's costing a lot of funding, even out of our own pockets, myself as well, to help people get on Suboxone. Some insurances don't even cover the Suboxone. So then we have to go out of our own pocket. As members of Natives Against Heroin, we put our money together out of our own pockets to provide people with Suboxone. So that way we are getting them out of active use or active withdrawal. There's a lot of work that we do on the ground. We help people that are homeless on the street that have nowhere to go. We help people get their children back that are losing their children to the child protection system. We help them get into treatment. But it's these grassroots organizing that is helping our people heal. We not only help them get out of that situation, we give them a step into leadership. They become an advocate, and they do it themselves as well. They do the same work. A lot of our members are past addicts. I'm an addict in recovery of opiates. When I was 20 years old, I had a surgery. And when I had that surgery, I didn't realize I was an addict. I didn't know what I was doing until I started almost losing my children. When I was going to lose my children, that's when reality started to hit. But I still was in full-blown addiction, and I couldn't stop it. It was like a train that I was riding, and I had no control. It was up to my family, my community, and the people around me that stopped me from falling farther down that tunnel. And it was forcefully stopped. I was literally locked in my house for 6 months away from people, away from my friends, just so I wouldn't go back into the addiction. It took me 6 months to actually have a mind of my own again. And it was extremely difficult to do it on my own. And I still do it today. Just this past year, I ran for state representative to sit amongst you. And after the election, I found out I had ulcerative colitis. I was hospitalized for 2.5 weeks, and I'm still going in and out of the hospital. Their fix for me was to put me back on opiates. And I'm still struggling to fight against the addiction. And it's still a struggle today. And you got to understand, I'm fighting for not only myself, I'm fighting for my girls, I'm fighting for everybody's children that are out here. And I need you guys to all fight too, because I can't fight this alone. I'm not only fighting my own demons, my own traumas. I'm indigenous, yes, and we have a lot of trauma already, and there's a lot of pain already, not only in our blood, but in our generations that is passed down. But yet I'm still fighting, and I need you guys to help us fight. I need you guys to help hold the pharmaceutical companies accountable for what they have done and what they're continuing to do. Because yet I'm still being prescribed opiates, even though I tell the doctor that I am a past addict and I'm afraid of them. I am afraid of opiates. I am afraid of having to pick up a Percocet, because I don't know how many times I have to pick up that Percocet and know which one of those pills are going to be the one that drive me on that train again. So I do this work to help you guys realize that you guys have power. And I tried to run to help sit amongst you and help teach you guys what it is that you guys don't see. I wanted to sit with you so that way I can help you learn. But maybe I can help you learn from this side of the table. And I'm hoping I can do that. So please, this isn't a lot. We're asking pennies for a pill when it takes lives. When I've buried my family members, when I've buried my friends, no pharmaceutical company is going to pay us for the lives we've lost and the children we've lost. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And I just want you to know we see your resiliency. So you just stay in that space.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself and share.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matthew DiLoretto, and I'm the Vice President of State Government Affairs at the Healthcare Distribution Alliance. First off, I would like to say that there are many aspects of the proposal of HF 400 that HDA does support. We think that there's many aspects of this that are positive and that would have a positive impact on this epidemic. However, HDA does have concerns with the wholesaler registration fee aspect of the legislation. HDA is the National Trade Association representing 36 primary wholesale distributors. And I think that's very important to remember that oftentimes the national conversation is focused on a small number of wholesale distributors, but there are a number of those out there. There are a number of wholesale distributors. HDA represents 36 of them. They range from large national corporations to small regional-based wholesalers that might be privately owned. And I'd also like to take some time to educate everyone in the room on the role of wholesale distributors within the supply chain. Wholesale distributors are a critical link in the healthcare supply chain that deliver medicines and healthcare supplies safely, securely, and efficiently to virtually every healthcare delivery setting in the country: pharmacies, hospitals, physicians' offices, and so forth. Excuse me. The products HDA members deliver range from the most common over-the-counter products, such as antibiotics, allergy medicine, Band-Aids, and even toothpaste, to the most complex specialty prescription medications and virtually any medicine and medical supply. Again, oftentimes during the public conversation, you might read in the paper or so, what have you, that it's the opioid distributors. That's actually a very misleading statement. Wholesale distributors handle all types of healthcare products and medications. Opioids actually make up a small percentage of the overall volume that wholesalers ship each day in this country. When you walk into your doctor's office, your pharmacy, virtually anything you see in there, even beyond prescription medications, are typically handled by a wholesale distributor. HDA members companies work around the clock to ensure more than 200,000 licensed pharmacies, hospitals, long-term care facilities, clinics, and other healthcare providers are equipped with the critical products patients need. This is another very important aspect of the role of the wholesale distributor that I think it must be remembered. HDA members, primary wholesale distributors, do not research, manufacture, market, prescribe medications. Our members are not healthcare providers or prescribing or dispensing practitioners. They do not influence prescribing patterns. They also don't have any influence over a patient benefit design. HDA members go to great lengths to thoroughly verify and fulfill orders placed by DEA-licensed healthcare practitioners based on those practitioners' professional judgment of patient need. Essentially, we are the logistics arm of the supply chain. Our orders come in from DEA-licensed practitioners, and we complete those orders. We are not the medical practitioners or prescribers of the supply chain. HDA is committed to working with policymakers to positively influence the drug abuse epidemic impacting the nation and recognizes the intent of HF 400 is admirable. However, we do not support the legislation's specific provisions placing a significant financial penalty on the distribution of legitimate medications prescribed by DEA licensed practitioners. Basically, our concern is that this places a logistics-focused industry in the difficult position of either, one, absorbing a significant financial assessment based on a product representing a small portion of the overall product volume, potentially denying medical experts and patients they serve from their requested orders. Essentially, if a physician or a prescriber or licensed practitioner places an order saying that they wouldn't be able to access that, or passing a cost along to the distributor's customers and possibly the patients. This is essentially a no-win situation that could raise costs or decrease access for legitimate patients. And we must remember that not every opioid order is for, you know, ill use. Hospice centers, cancer centers. These are patients that might require these medications based on their prescribers' orders. What's more, the legislation's volume-based policy would result in an environment where even if prescription opioid demand would decrease, the multi-million dollar licensure fee would continue to place significant financial responsibility on the logistics arm of the system. In its current form, any volume of opioid product would result in the same, in this case, $8 million assessment. Essentially, and this is an extreme example, but just for numbers' sake, if there was one small regional wholesale distributor servicing a hospice center in Minnesota down the line, and that was the only volume going into the state, that small regional wholesaler servicing that hospice center would be responsible for $8 million. Essentially, a non-sustainable figure. HDA strongly supports a variety of policies that both decrease opioid demand and dispensing while encouraging safe disposal of medications. Like I said earlier in this discussion, some of those proposals are contained in HF 400 and we feel they should be supported. HDA does not advocate for the use of opioids. Licensed medical professional orders are what determine our shipments. We are not in the role of advocating for opioid use. The development of alternative pain treatments should be encouraged, and one day such options may become more widely available. That said, there may also continue to be a place for opioids in clinical management of pain. As a result, they should be accessible to patients when a licensed prescriber determines they are appropriate and clinically necessary. Another important aspect that must be remembered is the scope of medical procedures that use opioids is vast, not just including those received from routine pain management that gets put in the medicine cabinet, as I put it, and possibly diverted. opioid-containing products are used, for example, in epidurals during childbirth. They're used in virtually every surgical procedure to manage pain during that surgical procedure. These procedures would also be impacted by this assessment and especially impacted if there's a decreased access to opioid medication. Well, this proposal...
can I get you to...
Wrap up?
Yes.
Almost there. Yeah. While this proposal appears to reduce prescription opioid misuse by raising revenue for prevention and treatment programs, imposing a cost burden on the logistics arm of the supply chain is an oversimplified and flawed approach, we feel. And moving forward, HDA hopes to continue to work with legislators to find solutions to this issue, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony. Can I please have Dave Renner and Judy Cook?
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association. And I thank you for the opportunity to strongly support House File 400. The MMA has supported the opioid stewardship fee in the last two legislative sessions, and we're glad to see it moving forward again this year. We're also grateful for both Representative Olson and Representative Baker's leadership on these issues, and we've been trying to work with both over the years. The resources raised under the bill are long overdue and will be helpful in turning the tide in fighting opioid epidemic. Investments in treatment, services, education, both of prescribers and of patients, and prevention is critical. I do, however, need to point out one concern, and we have raised this with both Representative Baker and Representative Olson in the past. One provision is in the bill dealing with the mandate, the state law that mandates the type of continuing medical education that physicians and other prescribers must have. First of all, the MMA takes seriously the issue of education. As a matter of fact, we have focused on the issues of opioid education over the last 6 years. And we have worked closely with the Steve Brumler Hope Network and the University of Minnesota to create and distribute free lecture series devoted to pain, opioids, addiction, and safe prescribing. The MMA Pain, Opioid, and Addiction lecture series has been very successful, both available live and online, over 7,500 views, physicians throughout Minnesota as well as 48 other states. So we are not opposed to the concepts of education, and we clearly realize that prescribers, as I think Dr. Johnson referred to earlier, have needed to change their prescribing patterns, and we're glad to see that that is happening. Our concern, however, is when you start mandating in law the types of education that physicians and other prescribers may have. Again, we have seen many different issues over the last dozen years of legislation mandating different education on whatever hot topic happens to be coming up. And I just caution you to move slowly as we go down that road. Many times when you get into continuing medical education, one size does not fit all. Saying that, again, we strongly support this bill, and we look forward to working with Representative Olson and Representative Baker moving forward to address some of these concerns.
Thank you so much. Ms. Cook.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates, and I am representing the Association for Accessible Medicines. This is the organization representing generic drug manufacturers. Unfortunately, no one from AAM was able to be here today, but Brett Michelin, who is their Director of State Government Affairs, was here last week. I believe he'll be back next week to visit with you, and we can talk about this and other important issues you are considering which impact generics in the healthcare marketplace in Minnesota. We did appreciate the opportunity to talk with both Representative Olson and Representative Baker about this legislation last week and look forward to continuing to be a part of the discussions going forward. With respect to House File 400, AAM's members are reviewing the language, and as I said, we will be able to provide more detailed feedback very soon. AAM also recognizes that opioid and other forms of addiction are a significant public policy issue and a challenge for state and local government. A priority for AAM on opioid legislation remains access to appropriate care for those individuals for whom opioids are an important course of treatment, such as cancer or end of life. There is excellent work being done to develop and utilize best practices for the prescribing of opioids for those patients for whom these drugs are appropriate. But for those it is not, we support pill limits, use of the prescription monitoring program, and other best practices to significantly limit and reduce the prescribing and use of opioids as a way to prevent addiction. There are effective alternatives available that should be utilized more widely. Also, AAM is working to prevent future addiction by offering a program to educate high schoolers and college-age students about the dangers of opioid and other drug abuse. Our concern with this type of legislation is that it does not recognize what has happened since opioids were first brought to the market, when there were brand companies aggressively detailing to prescribers and insurers urging physicians to treat pain with these opioids. Now, the vast majority of opioids are manufactured by generic companies, which do not detail to physicians, nor conduct direct-to-consumer advertising. Since these drugs went off patent, there frequently are multiple generic companies making the same product. Not all generic manufacturers have opioid products. Opioids are like other generic drugs. More than 90% of what's prescribed are generic now, at less than a quarter of the cost. It's also important to note that generic manufacturers have no control over which of their products are sold in Minnesota. It's a national marketplace, and generics primarily are sold to three customers, the three wholesalers you just heard from. Also, the DEA determines, drug enforcement, determines how much any manufacturer can make of any given opioid, and that number has been reduced significantly each year. As we read this bill, the licensing fee will fall primarily on generic manufacturers, yet other entities in the supply chain have been and continue to be involved in prescribing and filling of opioid prescriptions. Generic manufacturers know they are part of the supply chain when patients are prescribed opioids and recognize they should have a fair role in addressing the problems that have arisen from use of opioids, and AAM is willing to participate in a fair system. Again, generic manufacturers did not create opioids, did not market them, did not pay physicians, are highly regulated, and only manufacture what the DEA allows. As you may know, a similar funding mechanism was found unconstitutional in New York. We encourage you to develop a proposal in Minnesota that will be fair and include all parties of the opioid supply chain, and we look forward to working with you on that. And I also am happy to take any questions. If I'm not able to answer them, I will pass them along and assure you we will get you answers. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. So can I have Jessica Webster and Bonnie Balash? Bonnie? Okay, can you introduce yourself and continue with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and I represent low-income people across the state. Legal Aid strongly supports this legislation, and we're particularly thankful to the families and the moms who have taken tremendous leadership on it. I do have one concern about something that's not included here. I don't want to slow this bill down, and I hope it can be considered separately in this committee. In 2012, this Health and Human Services Committee passed a law to get tougher on people, low-income people, who use opioids and other controlled substances. And beginning in 2012, parents with children in MFIP and single adults receiving general assistance, if they failed a drug test, they are cut off from assistance. We have represented single adults and families who have become homeless under this provision, and I hope that the committee can look at this going forward. The state law I referenced does not require treatment. It doesn't offer resources. It doesn't offer referrals. It doesn't have any compassionate component to it. And as a state, I think we're in a different place today than we were in 2012 about this conversation, and I hope that we can have a new conversation about this provision in the future. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for reminding of that. Okay. Please introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Chair Moran and members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Balash, and I'm a licensed acupuncturist. I'm very passionate about this issue because I've seen the devastation. I've heard the all-too-familiar story of a family member or friend who went in to receive treatment for pain and received an opioid, became addicted to an opioid, and died because of an opioid. This is not the way it should be. To me, the opioid epidemic represents we have a problem with the way we treat pain and how we handle addiction. We need compassion for these issues. We have over-relied on opioids for pain management, and we have a population of people that don't have access to evidence-based non-drug pain management like acupuncture. Acupuncture is not consistently a covered service, even though many pain guidelines and best practice documents recommend acupuncture for pain.
We have special populations that need access to non-drug options like acupuncture because they have conditions that put them at greater risk of death, addiction, and physical dependency. I'm thankful for the inclusion of the acupuncture coverage in the opioid product stewardship bill because we need options for pain management to address the many issues that the opioid epidemic has created in this in a comprehensive way. I am thankful for the coverage of acupuncture that is out there, but it is not available and covered for all, and that is what I hope will change. If I could change the world, I want to see acupuncturists in the emergency departments and acute and chronic pain coverage for acupuncture for all, and I want opioid prescribers to see that non-pharmacological pain management is the good part of pain management. Support acupuncture coverage. The second part I wanted to address is the prescriber education. This has been part of my acupuncture legislation that Representative Freiberg has sponsored for the last 3 years. Do I want mandated education? No. But what other options do we have? The CDC's number one recommendation is to try non-pharmacological pain management first. Opioid education was aggressive and misleading. How do we change that? I have been impressed with the licensing boards on this issue, as they have spent the last 15 years trying to educate about opioid pain management. But I believe there is a big information gap in the non-pharmacological pain management education in both training and continuing education. I am hoping the associations representing the professions will testify in support of this educational component and help the committee understand about this information gap when it comes to non-pharmacological pain management. We need a revolution and not an evolution in how we manage pain. And we need compassion and treatment for those who have suffered the consequences of pain medication addiction. Please support prescriber education. The Opioid Product Stewardship Bill offers comprehensive solutions to address a big issue. Thank you for your time and support, House File 400.
And thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can I have Charles Sawyer? Welcome. Introduce yourself. This is our last scheduled testifier, but we will be opening up to others who may want to testify also.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Chuck Sawyer. I'm a chiropractic doctor with Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. We train chiropractic doctors, acupuncturists, and we have two programs in therapeutic massage. So our institution, as small as it is 100% focused on healthcare and predominantly on pain and its management. I'm here today to support House File 400 because we feel optimistic that this legislation will allow us to make some urgent headway in addressing what I think is probably the most pressing public health problem in our day. I'm under no illusions that our professions can on our own solve the problem of acute and chronic pain. It's complicated, and often musculoskeletal pain, most notably back pain, starts that tragic cascade toward opioid dependence and ultimately worse. With that said, there are two provisions in this bill that are important in our view. First is the requirement for covering acupuncture in all health plans. Acupuncture is a remarkably safe and commonly effective treatment for pain. There's practically never any downside to that therapy, and more importantly, when a patient in pain, particularly with musculoskeletal pain, sees an acupuncturist or a chiropractic doctor, there is no expectation of medication being prescribed of any kind, much less an addictive narcotic. But the coverage for acupuncture is spotty, as you just heard, across and inconsistent across insurance plans and products. The second provision requiring continuing education for physicians, nurse practitioners, and dentists is also important in our view because their knowledge of non-pharmacologic therapies is also incomplete. A two-hour requirement in our view is reasonable and we believe would be effective in helping our colleagues in other professions to become better acquainted with the training that we have, the care that we provide, and the value. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So at this time, we would like to just open it up to anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 400. come down?
Yeah, thank you. I wasn't going to do this, but
it's okay.
I feel strongly that I must.
So please,
I lost my 20.
Please introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Joan Barron. I live in Ramsey, Minnesota. October 22nd, 2014, I lost my 29-year-old son to the opiate epidemic. Where he got those opiates from was from my purse. I have been in horrific chronic pain since 2001 when I took a traumatic fall off my front step. Within 6 months, I was prescribed everything under the book. I put my medications for my doctor in my kitchen cupboard, like I did with all my prescriptions. It wasn't until I was in an accredited pain clinic that I was told to keep those medications locked up. I live in both worlds, where I really don't fit in with some of the parents here, and I'm stuck in the middle because I'm in horrific pain. I suffer with pudendal neuralgia, a rare nerve disorder of the pelvis, which affects my pelvic floor, evacuating everything. The pain, I'm going to be in bed for 2 days for pulling today off with an ice pack in my pants for the next 2 days. We have got to find a way where it begins with us, with me. It began with my pain. You're right. And you know what? For those that have found acupuncture therapy wonderful for them, that's great. You should go for that. You know what my family had to do? Went to Mayo. Mayo sent us to France. I went to France and had spent 4 weeks and had a complex surgery, only to be left with a damaged nerve on the right side. And here I sit 18 years later, still in horrific pain, still mourning what my family lost. We paid the ultimate sacrifice. 18 years of lost wages, and we also lost our son to it. So it didn't matter after I was told to keep him locked up. I had 3 or 4 safes in my house. And, of course, I was always told if Adam stole my checkbook that we should press charges against him, and I did twice. 2 felony charges I pressed against him, and all it did was make matters worse. I live in both worlds, where I know that there is a need to deal with this, but I'm also in horrific chronic pain. So I have entered the medical cannabis program. My $40 at CVS now costs me $400 to choose a safer alternative. $400 a month, that's a car payment. And my family needs a car right now. I've gone from 80 milligrams of methadone 3 times a day to 110 milligram tab, period. That's significant. All those pills now are never going to fall into the wrong hands. And I just want you to take in consideration the chronic pain patient, because it began with us, and it begins with us. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. We really appreciate it. So is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify? Come to the table. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Sherry Smalls. I'm from the Jake Sake Foundation. I'm here to talk about what we've done and what we want to do with this bill. As we have, last 3 years, fought to get this bill in. Last year it did very well. And this last fall, we also did some pilot programming in the schools. We got great results from the kids. They really liked it. They learned a lot, and they want it. I just hope that we can get education into the schools, and they hear it every year. Because my son Jake, the one thing he said, he had no idea how addicted opiates were. And I hear that all the time from the kids I've talked to and stuff. So I just hope that we can get this passed and save our youth and honor the ones that have died. I mean, my life, every day I think of Jake, I'm heartbroken every day. He just didn't know, and he was a smart kid. He was had everything going for him. Athletic, wrote for the school paper. He just had tons of friends. He was just loved by everybody. And I don't want to see any of the parents to go through the pain that I go through every day. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Thank you. So to the members, you want to testify?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Introduce yourself, please.
My name's Valerie Quintana. Thank you, Madam Chair. This has all been very enlightening. I haven't been very involved on this end of the table, so to speak, or this end of the disease. I am what one of the women called, I suffer from a disease of despair. I am a heroin addict. I have been sober for 22 years. I am very active in recovery. I come from a very loving, kind family. This is not a moral issue. I was always a good person. I was a college graduate, and I got very involved in opiates to the point of living as a homeless person, dying of alcoholism, incarcerated a number of times, and weighed about 100 pounds, didn't eat, didn't sleep, and did anything imaginable to support my habit, which was atrocious and nearly killed me many times. I lost my boyfriend on 4th of July, 1995, and that thrust me into a deeper addiction. And it wasn't until August 7th of 1996 where I got sober through treatment and intervention and that sort of thing. So I'm now on the other end of the disease. In many, many ways, I work in the field. I'm not a counselor or in any way a clinical person. I provide housing for many alcoholics and addicts in recovery. And I also raise a child that was born addicted to heroin. She is, in fact, my granddaughter by marriage. And she is, as someone shared, a young, innocent life that was born 5 pounds addicted to heroin, weaning off methadone, shaking in an incubator. 10 years ago, we thought we'd have her a few days. I was sweet in love with my boyfriend, who we just did not know we were having a child. 6 days later, we brought this child home. And so I have watched her suffer from the addiction as well. There is an epidemic. Clearly, we've heard all of the statistics and are aware. I also would like to address the epidemic that will be affecting our children that are born addicted. She does have a special education plan. Crack babies are recognized from the 80s, alcohol fetal syndrome is recognized, but you don't often hear about the effects of heroin addiction on a child and the long-term effects of a noxious placenta. So I'm here representing my beautiful, beautiful child. She's brilliant, athletic, fabulous, but her brain will never be the same as a child who did not suffer from a mother who probably didn't eat, who was always in stress, and had a lot of poison in her body. I also want to put a shout out to the Steve Rumler organization. Many years ago, I adopted their Narcan in my homes and was one of the early adopters. And every month at our potluck, we share about how to use it appropriately. And 2 months ago, a young woman did overdose in the home, which is the unfortunate reality of the business that I'm in. She overdosed, and fortunately her parents had come over to bring some oatmeal that Sunday at noon, and one of the senior residents in the home grabbed the Narcan kit and administered it. She did survive. She was in a coma for 3 weeks. She is still alive. The paramedics that came also administered the Narcan. So I'm here to just also just really stress the importance of prevention. As I just talked about, you know, we want our children, sisters, mothers, daughters to live. I say women. I've for a long time worked in the women's housing, but men too, of course. For my late Billy, my boyfriend 23 years ago. But I also, you know, then what? So we survive and then what? So this funding will also help with not just treatment, and, you know, she talked about acupressure or acupuncture, but also education and housing. For me, a big struggle, and what I would like to see some of the funding towards, would be all of the barriers and obstacles that when someone is sober and leaves my sober homes, it's very hard for them with their lack of employment history, their lack of rental history, to find a home to live. because of their rental history and where their addiction has brought them. So these barriers make them go back to their unhealthy situations, and it becomes then a revolving door of addiction where they get out of my homes and then once again go to the ex-boyfriend or their grandmother's basement because of these obstacles around education, around rental history, employment history, and things like that. So I think, you know, a sense of purpose, you know, really needs to be looked at as well. We help them to survive, and so then how do we give them a sense of purpose? So I would like to see some of that funding go towards college education and things of that nature. Thank you so much for letting me share.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Okay, members, do you have any questions from any of the testifiers? Or? Okay, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, well, first of all, I just want to thank everybody who testified and thank our two legislators who brought this bill. I mean, this is a very emotional and very, very compelling issue, and I am really hopeful, as I know so many of us are, probably all of us are, that we can do something meaningful this year on this. Madam Chair, we only have 2-3 minutes. I would put this to your discretion. I really wanted to ask some questions of Mr. DiLoretto, who spoke for the Healthcare Distribution Alliance and talked about the 36 wholesale distributors in the state and so on. I was under the impression we only have 3 who sell here. And I don't know if we don't have time to get into that now, but we'll hear the bill elsewhere, so I'll be okay to pass on that and just kind of put that out there and let others go ahead.
This is a really big bill. It's a very comprehensive bill, and what we're going to do is just come back this afternoon after dinner. So I'm going to recess and be called back at the call of the chair. So the question is whether or not your testifier will be around. And he will be here. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. So what we're going to do, and I'm hoping as many members in the audience who can will also come back and join us. So we need to reconvene for now. We're going to recess for now. I believe we need to vacate this room because the Republican caucus they need this space here. And we will be called back at the call of the chair.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, will the members of the committee be identified in advance of when you intend to come back? Is there an anticipated time of when we might come back?
So the hope is that it'd be around 6:30. Chris McCall, my CA, will send out an email to everyone to that exact time.
Great.
And we will reconvene in this room.
And Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Just a question, Madam Chair. Quick question. You're not reconvening because I have a question.
No,
I hope, because I would withdraw that question. Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're going to call the Committee of Health and Human Service Policy back to order. I think I said this earlier, you know, it's often enough to come into our committees or into our works as legislators, but we have, like, great people who are beside us making things run smooth and taking care of the business of the committee. And one such person would be Catherine today. Catherine is our page, and I just want to say thank you for helping to move us and get us set up here in this new space. Thank you so much. Before us, we still have the bill before us, and let's spend some time discussing the bills. I would like to open this up to the members, and let's keep in mind that this bill is going to be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. So in saying that, members, do we have any discussions, questions?
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering about the order of business tonight. I know that there are a few amendments that were not adopted on earlier, and I'm just wondering if we're going to take those before we go into questioning, or when, at what point would be appropriate to talk about the amendments that are still pending.
Yes. Representative Albright, yes. So what I wanted to do was just open it up just for members if they had any anything they want to discuss as questions, and from that we were going to move into the amendments. So we are definitely going to take the amendments up. So we have no questions?
Well,
okay,
yes.
Representative Albright. Oh, okay, she was done. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Olson, first and foremost, thank you for being a co-author on this bill. You and I have talked about this, and we both share a most earnest desire to put the people that are suffering from this first and foremost. That being said, though, I think that this committee also wants to make sure that we get it right, so that there aren't unintended consequences because of something that this committee didn't undertake a conversation about, didn't vet properly. So to that extent, I have a couple of questions for you. The first is, in the body of the bill, and you mentioned it during your presentation of the bill, we make assessment of fees only to wholesalers and manufacturers. There are certainly other participants.
I'm sorry. Representative Olson, would you like to respond?
I'm still going. Yeah. So there are certainly other participants in the drug distribution, system. And I'm just wondering, did you consider those? Why is there an emphasis on just those two participants to the distribution chain? And mind you, none of these questions are intended to be derogatory. I'm just trying to understand the process that was undertaken in putting the bill together. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Albright, I think, the conversation, and, Representative Baker can jump in, is, anybody's welcome to the table who wants to contribute to the crisis financially. I think we'd be happy to sit down and talk with folks who have ideas for revenue generation. And so if there are further thoughts on that, I think we could certainly talk about it. I think as we've chatted, and the conversation is really like, there's so many folks already paying into this crisis in a variety of ways. And so looking at those who have not yet had a stake in this, like, for example, registration fees being to the tune of $235 right now. I mean, there's some change that needs to happen to that. So I think, I think open to further revenue generation, if the skin in the game is putting funds on the table, I think inevitably that's a good thing.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is either to Representative Olson or Representative Baker. But as you considered other fee structures, and I know Representative Baker, you and I have talked about this numerous times, and there have been iterations in the last couple of sessions. We went through the per pill fee structure. We went through kind of a fee or revenue sharing on the revenue generated within the system as it comes into the state. Why did you settle on this structure as opposed to any of the other ones?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I think ultimately is because it was the simplest. And it was the one that was the cleanest method after visiting with some of the boards, Board of Pharmacy, other folks that have actually kind of seen a clearer path to this. It's not encumbered with a milligram equivalent. It's a licensing reform. And also, our state has been exposed to some of this with the Senate language, and it's similar to that. So it has actually sort of passed a litmus test over there. So we think it was a good foundation to start working with.
Representative Olson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd also, just to something that was said earlier in regards to this as well, this does not have the New York language in it as well. We are careful in thinking about the structures we have. This does not have what the New York lawsuit, we don't have that in this language. So we also were thoughtful about what is happening in other, you know, states and seeing what's been working and not working and being cognizant of that as we also put this together.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, Representative Olson, while I certainly agree with the intention to not include the New York language in this bill, I would also observe that there is, in the calculation of the fee, you're looking back at sales from the previous year as opposed to front forward looking in terms of almost like an accrual of a fee. And so from a legality standpoint, is there any concern on your part or have anyone in the distribution chain expressed concern about why are you looking backward on previous year's sales as opposed to looking forward on future revenues or sales into the system? Because I think therein lies an inference for a punitive action based upon what you did the previous year. I'm not an attorney. I don't even play one on TV. But it just makes the appearance that you're creating somewhat of a punitive fee based upon what they did last year. That's my interpretation. I look for your response.
Representative.
Madam Chair.
Representative Baker.
I think, again, I would say that we took advice from some boards and the way that we can fairly ask for the fees on a historical matter is pretty relative to looking at a 12-month window. Now, if we want to look at some new ideas about how to get the right numbers, I think Representative Olson and I are here to say, find us $20 million. However we get there, I don't think that matters. But what we want to do is to make sure that if historical, for example, McKesson does X amount of volume in a year, if Purdue Pharmaceutical does X amount of dollars, and we look back a 12-month window, I don't think normally it changes dramatically from year to year. I think their market shares may shift a tiny bit. But if you look at a a company like McKesson, if I'm not mistaken, I think, and I could be wrong, and excuse me if I am, but I think they do all the Walgreens business. And if they do, that's going to be relatively consistent unless something majorly changes to the market. It's what we are using now, and if there's a better way, I think we'd love to hear that idea.
Representative Albright. Thank you, Madam Chair. The DEA caps the number, or the quantity, I should say, of opioid pills that come into the state of Minnesota or available, or I should just back up and say that each generic manufacturer or pharma manufacturers. But are you providing a disincentive for them not to make pills available in the state of Minnesota so you would actually undercut the need for those types of drugs for, let's say, hospice care, palliative? Are you harming the very people that might need them the most by diminishing the desire for people to participate in the state with those types of pharmaceuticals?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. First, just to back up, what we're talking about is places that have made billions of dollars and have not been asked to pay. And we're talking about maybe thinking about a pharmacy in a town that has 4,000 people, and they're getting a request for 9,000 opioids to be coming into their pharmacy. There should be some questions and accountability around that. So we're not trying to limit or penalize. It's about accountability, where there hasn't been accountability, and an ability to know what we haven't known before and to hold accountable what hasn't been held accountable.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that I probably am indulging your patience, but I do have a series of questions, so thank you. I understand that. But in the same context, when you say bring accountability to the system, doesn't that also infer that you are bringing justice or a punitive action against the people who have brought those into the state? And the reason I bring that up is because that is the very nature of what happened in New York. And so are we going down the same road as what New York did, but only under slightly different circumstances, where if we pass this into law, does this invite legal action by any one of the people in the distribution chain that could tie up the benefits for the very people that we want to provide care to?
Madam Chair.
Before you respond, Representative Albright, you've reframed the question, but it's the same question. So, but I want to just say that I'm getting a long list over here, and so I would like for Representative Olson to respond to your question, because I think it's a very good question. But I would also like to create space to get some of the other questions asked, and then we can also come back.
Yep.
Would that be okay?
Yeah, that'd be fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, I was going to answer that, but I forgot the question.
President Baker.
Well, Madam Chair, I would say the New York law specifically had the piece about being able to track a pill across state lines. We don't have that in this bill. So just to your point about the New York piece in this, and that is what's different about this. And so we're not asking for that. And and ideally, consumers don't want to pay more. And that part was about trying to have protections for the consumers, but it was brought to court to say, you know, we can't tell how a pill is going across state lines, and therefore that was the piece. So we don't have that in here. But if you want to work around an accountability measure to make sure, or, you know, not accountability measure in your language, but if you want to work to make sure that we're protecting the people's in their pocketbooks, I'd be happy to figure out how we do that.
Madam Chair, let me speak. Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Baker.
So, again, I think Representative Albright asked a very good question. It would not shock me or surprise me one bit if they wanted to challenge us in court. We're the first in the nation to get to this point, and I would not be surprised by that. What's different, again, about the New York model, we're a fifth of the size. We've earmarked this licensing reform to be focused on substance abuse recovery and harm reduction and what goes along with that. So I think that, and again, we, as Representative Olson has said, we also don't have that language that kind of kicked it out of the New York system, if you would. We think the bill is really clean. It's not perfect, and we may be challenged. In fact, it would not surprise me, like I said. They're going to want to tie this up a long time. So the cleaner we all make this, the better this bill should be, and then let's get it challenged. But every year that goes by that not allows that challenge to happen is another year that we're not helping people.
Okay. Representative Robin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker and Representative Olson, for bringing this bill forward. And also thank you to all the testifiers today. It was very brave and courageous of you to come and share your stories, and I know also the weather wasn't great, and you're still here, and it's been a long day. So great thanks to all of you for being here. I share the goals of this bill, but I do have some concerns, as I shared with both of you this afternoon, and I appreciate the time you spent with me on such a busy day. So I have two questions. The first comes from one of the testifiers today. One of the testifiers, Margarita Ortega, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that, said that her insurance didn't cover Suboxone. I may not be pronouncing that right as well. Forgive me. So you do require insurance to cover acupuncture and chiropractic. So is there a reason we couldn't make them also require this particular drug that helps with the treatment?
Representative Olson?
Madam Chair, I think we should ask someone. I think that's beyond our scope. That's okay. A technical question. I don't know what her insurance was. I can't remember the program she said she was on.
Right.
I think that would take a deeper dive into exactly what, I mean, we want to get people the care and recovery and treatment they need and the wraparound there, you know, everything that goes with that. So I don't know without her story here again, and I don't know that that's within the scope of us to answer without knowing her, you know, more question on that. But I think we're all for having access to people to be able to have access to the resources for recovery that they need.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more question. So one of the questions I had in doing background research on this was the use of changing it from what it was last year to now defining it as a unit for purposes of assessing the fee. And so I would just like a little more clarification, because it's not defined, that I could find what you mean by unit. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm gonna look to our expert here, but I think what a unit is, and just shake your head, and I'm going to do my phone a friend thing, and I'm looking right at Cody. I think a unit means a pill. And if I'm wrong, I would ask then the Board of Pharmacy Executive Director to come up to answer that very good question.
Thank you.
Okay.
You can come to the testifiers table, please.
Madam Chair, we probably wouldn't have got through this hearing without hearing from Cody.
Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy that would administer the program if this legislation passes. A unit, basically, Representative Robbins, is you can think of it as what the patient would use. So the vast majority of units are probably going to be tablets and capsules, so that's why Representative Baker's correct, but there are other sorts of dosage forms. So it could be a milliliter if it's a liquid preparation. It could be a patch for a fentanyl patch. So, but you can think of it as anything that it's the ultimate dosage form that the patient's going to use.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. One of the things that we do a lot when we have bills is give things a definition so that we can be really clear about what it stands for. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Representative Olson for bringing this bill forward, and to my fellow third term Representative Baker. I know this is really meaningful to you, and this is great work. It seems really needed from what I can tell, and needed quickly. So thank you for that. I wanted to just maybe give some reassurance to Representative Albright a bit. I am a lawyer. I'm not rendering legal advice. I just want to make sure we're clear. No free advice, Representative Backer. But as Representative Baker said, I think that anything can be challenged in court, and this may well be if it's first in the country, and Minnesota's leading the way as we do. But the point about it being punitive, it seems to me if the state were imposing some large liability on companies that then we were using to fund all sorts of other things and really trying to direct apparent punishment at them, that kind of thing, that'd be one thing. But in this case, it seems like, if I'm reading this right, that we've made a determination that a certain amount of funding is needed to address what an economist called the negative externalities of the behavior of these companies and of when what comes out of their work. And I actually don't mean behavior in a pejorative way, but just sort of in the course of doing business, there are these negative externalities that come out of it. And so there's a certain amount of money, and then the amount is prorated based on the sales that are in the most recent year, which makes sense because, in fact, the impact of those sales will then be felt going forward into the future. So I guess, if anything, it seems like a really rational scheme, and very much the opposite of something that would be viewed as directing punishment at companies, and rather more just trying to capture the cost, trying to deal with the costs of this product that's being sold and being used in that way. So I guess I don't have concerns. Again, lawsuits may be brought, but certainly regarding that particular point and the overall point, it seems to me that this should withstand that concern and really make a big difference for our state. So thank you both again. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair, and I too thank you guys for your work. And I'm not going to repeat everything else that's been said here on the appreciation, but we do appreciate the efforts. My question deals with is, you're forming, from what I understand, a new board. What powers does that board have? I mean, that's my first question, Chair.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Backer. So we are forming an advisory council, and this will stop in government operations, so we'll have a chance to talk more about that as well. That will be a chance to really dive in there. So I'll make note of that. But this would be an advisory council that you see that we're setting up a grant program in various areas, and we'll have commissioners making decisions, and we'll have advisement around the different parts of the bill regarding the appropriation of some of these grants, and we'll be guiding the work of the commissioners.
Representative
Thacker. Follow up. Thank you. And I appreciate that, Representative Olson. So, but what I can understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, just so we understand the dynamics of this, is that they will make a recommendation to DHS. And then from there, that appropriation would be done. They will not be making direct appropriation from this committee. Is that correct?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Backer. Yes, and not just to DHS, as you'll see, there's different appropriation places in this bill, but it's a recommendation.
Okay. And one more question here.
Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair. Representative Olson, Representative Baker, in regards with, I understand also in the bill that they would be gaining approximately $1 million. Where to operate this committee, where would that, what would that resources be used for with that committee? What's your thoughts on that? Representative Olson and Baker, thank you.
Representative Olson.
Madam Chair and Representative Backer, so you've also probably noticed in the amendment that we have charged this group. We want to have representation. We heard testifiers today very clearly say that the communities most impacted often know a lot about the solutions. And so we wanted to have voices at the table from various stakeholder groups to help make these decisions around how we use this funding. And so we thought it was important to give them a really clear voice. And so we've moved these to quarterly. We'd like to convene the council quarterly. And as you know, being a part of this body, when we convene groups this size and we make important decisions, that it takes staff time, it takes resources to convene us. And so I think there's an element that if we take this council seriously and these stakeholders' voices seriously, that we need to make sure that we bring them together in a powerful way that has staff support, that has time and resources devoted to make sure that they're able to do a really good job at allocating these funds.
Representative Thacker.
Thank you.
Okay, so I want to just give Representative Albright an opportunity.
Oh, yay! Well, you know, I'm just very
could I ask for Dr. Weiberg to return to the testifier stand?
Yes, please. Can you return to the testifier table, please? Can you reintroduce yourself?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg, Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy.
Thank you.
Dr. Weiberg, good evening. The Board of Pharmacy under this is going to be overseeing a very substantial responsibility, and one of those things is that we've heard is about tracking the data. And my presumption is that you are going to be creating a tracking technology. Is that true?
Madam yes. Chair, Representative Albright, that is correct. We would be working with our prescription monitoring program vendor to collect the data. It's going to be supplied in a particular format that wholesalers already have to use when they supply data to the Drug Enforcement Administration. It's called ARCOS data, is the acronym. And yes, we'll have to collect that data, and we'll have to keep that in a database, and the software will also have to include the ability to analyze the data and to generate invoices and to track payments.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Weiberg, not to be mm-hmm. flippant about that, but we haven't had a real good track record with technology development around this place. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering, in the conversation you just and I had, it sounds like there is an outside vendor that is already on board to create this, and you're enhancing that, or is it from the ground up that you're creating this technology?
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, yes, we have a vendor called APRISS, APPRISS, that it manages our prescription monitoring program. This would be something new to them, but we've had extensive discussions with them. I've been working on this for over 2 years now, so we've had discussions with them about the possibility, and this is something that they assure us can do. We did address the concern that Minute had that my initial timeline, and I'll admit, my initial timeline was probably a little bit too rosy, which is why we're in working with the authors saying that we're not going to be able to collect this money this fiscal year. It will take some time for the vendor to put this into place.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are substantial sections in the bill as presented that talk about the rulemaking process, not only initially but in the appeals process. Could you speak to a little bit to that and how government operations, I know that's the next stop, so you'll touch on that, but from a policy perspective, who will be involved in that and how do you see that going forward?
Dr. White.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I don't believe, and I have to take a look at it again, but I don't believe any of the sections that currently involve the Board of Pharmacy involve rulemaking. At one point in time, one of the earliest drafts I saw did create something called a non-opioid healthcare directive, and that was going to be the Board of Pharmacy. I think that involved rulemaking. But my technical assistance, Representative Olson, would be that it would be better for the Department of Health to take on that responsibility because they already take care of health care directives. So I don't think there's anything left in the bill that involves Board of Pharmacy rulemaking.
Okay. So that's under your purview right now, Madam Chair.
Dr. Weiber.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, what's under our purview?
The
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The non-opioid directive.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, non-opioid directives don't exist right now. This bill would have called to create it. The initial language would have called for the Board of Pharmacy to do it, but I believe the A1 amendment makes it the Health Department that's now going to do that.
Okay. All right. Okay. And maybe my final question, just
Representative Albright.
And Dr. Weiberg. This seems to be a very substantial leap forward in terms of the responsibility for the Board of Pharmacy. Are other boards of pharmacy in other states doing similar work of this nature? And if so, I serve on State Government Finance, so what type of ramp up or staff up will be considerate for these measures under your board?
Dr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, this is something of a ramp up. It's not the first that we've done. Since I started as executive director 13 years ago, that would be the prescription monitoring program. Mm-hmm. So that was quite different than anything I think any health licensing board did. This is something that will require some additional staff and resources. We've prepared fiscal notes in the past. I believe that it's about four FTEs potentially to do this. There is some money during the first fiscal year to do the systems development. That money drops down in subsequent fiscal years to be included part of our ongoing licensing and maintenance contract with the vendor. But yes, there will be some additional work that needs to be done. Of course, I'm not sure that the legislation will pass in this form. But between this and other things that are working its way through the legislature, I anticipate we're one way or the other, we're probably going to need additional staff. So, the criminal background check office, which is right next door to us, is moving, and I've already got their space reserved in case we need it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the authors for working on this. And I want to point out in your documents, there's a document from St. Louis County on opioid-related costs. And I just want to highlight the fact that St. Louis County, the county that I live in, along with Representative Olson, spent $26 million, $26 million from 2014 through 2017 on out-of-home placement, treatment costs, treatment for opioid addiction and other drug abuse, medication-assisted treatment, having a substance abuse prevention and intervention initiative. So this is just one county, $26 million. So when Representative Pinto suggests there's externalities, these costs need to be recouped from the pharmaceutical companies themselves. Those responsible, knowing that opioids are addictive and pushing these drugs out or marketing these drugs, and not informing, possibly giving all the information to physicians when they're prescribing. But I think we need to go back in time and capture this revenue from pharmaceutical companies for the cost they've inflicted in Minnesota by county. So it would be great to see what every county's expense is, not just one. We have 87 counties. So it's a true cost, and I hope the lawsuits that are going forward will be successful to capture the costs that every county has experienced to try to treat and address opioid addiction.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz, you proved my point by your very words. You just said you look back and see what the damage is done, and you're assessing someone for that damage. That's an actionable item. Representative Pinto, you can certainly weigh in this, but I would infer by what you just said that that is a punitive, this becomes a punitive action. So I don't disagree with the desire to, you know, work on this, but I warn the committee to think of it in terms of a punitive action. We ought to be thinking about what is at the center of this, and that's helping the people who are suffering from this very dreadful, you know, situation, rather than holding someone accountable for actions. I know it's somewhat similar, but what you just said causes me concern in terms of litigation, because now someone's on the record saying exactly why they want to put this into an actionable item. Enough said.
Representative Pinto, do you want to respond?
I should let Representative Schultz respond first,
yes,
if she wants,
thank you,
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, no, I'm talking about the litigation that's already in process as well, that I hope that litigation is successful so we can recover the $26 million our county has incurred on addressing the opioid crisis. And there's significant evidence that suggests the pharmaceutical companies knew what they were doing, knew that this drug was highly addictive, and continued to market it.
Representative Fisher, or Pinto.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just might as well weigh into this. So if you think about the basic structure of a civil action, civil responsibility, right? So a manufacturer does something, and the person who is then harmed, who experiences some kind of cost, has the right, in theory, to go back and say, hey, you caused me to incur this additional cost. St. Louis County had to incur additional costs. That, I assume, is in part the basis for the lawsuit going backwards, I understand, going retrospectively, as Representative Schultz is referring to. The issue, though, is that the lawsuit going forward then, right? What you do going forward is you say, we now are experiencing ongoing costs. The costs are directly attributable to conduct. This is not something where there's an open-ended expense where we're going to say we're going to slap on, you know, $1,000 a pill because we're going to teach you a lesson. We're going to be punitive in some way, and if it adds up to $1 billion or it adds up to $1 million, we don't care because we want to punish you. That's punitive. Instead, we're saying we're incurring costs that probably far exceed $20 million, but we're going to say $20 million is going to be what we're going to fairly say that we need as payment from these entities that have caused us to incur costs. And to my mind, there's a precise and direct relationship. This is the exact opposite of punitive. This is entirely saying we're experiencing costs and we need to go to those who caused those costs and say, hey, you need to pay in to help us with those costs. Punitive goes well beyond where you're imposing some sort of punishment in that way. And to my mind, this seems entirely rational. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to also thank our co-authors up there for all the great work that you're doing on this bill. And I kind of want to build on what Representative Pinto said is, this is to take care of the damages that are going to be happening to society going forward. We already do that on a number of other things in our state. Take a look at the taxes we do on on cigarettes. Take a look at the taxes that we do on alcohol. And there have been times where we've done tax increases or fee increases and on the wholesale level in the alcohol industry, doing some of these same type of things to provide the funds out there to address the solutions, to address the evils that sometimes come with overuse of these different things. We've even done things to try to do it in the gambling area. So this is not unusual for us to be doing this type of thing, and I think it's a great way to be addressing problems that come from this product being out on the market, and we very reasonable, and we should continue in this process.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill authors. I was just reading through Section 5 on page 6 here, and the veterinary hospital piece kind of struck out to me. I heard from our local vets back home about people who, when they are addicted, they'll go to lengths of breaking their own pets' legs to get the opioids there to use for themselves. When there is a sale of a legitimate opioid prescription for an animal, will that be part of this too then? For the wholesalers and the manufacturers, are those opioids that are sold, is that going to be part of the fee structure here too?
Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to bring up Cody again to answer that with any more technical aspect, but I believe so. Yes, and long okay. and short, but I think Cody, it's yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. So I think, is there any more discussion? Because we do have a couple of amendments that we would like to present. Do we have authors of those amendments who would like to move them forward? Okay, Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I'd move the A5 amendment.
So they should be in your package. To the amendment, Ms. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, members, the A5 amendment inserts the language from House File 99 that we heard yesterday. That discussion was laid on the table for lack of time, but I think the proposal is a smart one that helps fight against this opioid situation. In historical perspective, similar language was proposed last year and was passed as part of the opioid package. We know that emergency departments are failing patients by discharging them back into the community with an overdose situation just to see them return a couple days later with a similar set of circumstances. So we need to make sure that they get that second chance. And I think utilizing, in the case of Representative Freiberg's legislation, his bill, provides those individuals with an opportunity to check on them in their home, give them the care that they need, and get them off to a better start after they recover. So I would ask for your support of the A5 amendment.
All right. Representative Olson, any comment to the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Albright. I think this, as we've talked about, we're not going to fix everything in one bill. There's a lot of great things out there that are open for debate, being to your point that this is already a bill moving. It's in the committee process. It's carried by someone else, but you're bringing forward as amendment, and it's still at play. I would just encourage folks to vote no on this.
All right. Any further discussion?
Okay. Madam Chair, I think this is an opportunity to provide for the paramedic and the emergency services response groups with an opportunity to have a seat at the table. This is an opportunity to knit this into the overall structure of the Stewardship Oversight Committee. This is not a partisan attempt to hijack a bill. I think it makes good sense for this. It's unfortunate that the author of the bill is taking exception with that. I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, this is the bill, as you pointed out, Representative Albright. This is the bill that I introduced. I think it's promising. Pilot program potentially. I was kind of surprised that you were offering it, considering you'd raised several questions about the scope of practice yesterday. So apparently those have been resolved to your satisfaction is what I'm presuming from the fact that you're offering this here. You know, those questions are kind of what led to it being laid over yesterday because we ran out of time. I'm comfortable with this continuing to move forward through the normal committee process, so I don't want it to jeopardize the larger bill, which I think is a really important issue. I'm comfortable that this will move forward, and apparently I was thinking we should wait on this just because there are these questions about scope of practice out there. I guess they're resolved, but at the same time, so maybe that's encouraging for when we do bring this forward eventually in this committee. But I don't want to jeopardize the larger opioid discussion here, so I will be voting with the author of House File 400 on this.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd just simply like to know if this was to go on the bill, whether Representative Albright would then be voting for the bill.
Madam Chair and Chair Liebling, a very good question. This is a piece of legislation that we've heard from both authors is a work in process. And while I have great aspirations for this to complete its journey and work the kinks out, as I've shared with both Representative Baker and Representative Olson, this is my attempt to make this bill better. I don't think it's ready yet. It has a number of stops. At this point, although I am in support of the endeavor, I think it needs some more work. I think this is an opportunity to enhance it. But to your question, in terms of support yet now, no. But there are a number of stops, and I'll look forward to see it in those other stops, Ways and Means being one of those, before it hits the floor sometime soon.
Is there any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I'll withdraw the amendment at this time.
All right. Thank you.
Do you want to roll call this?
So Representative Albright withdrawal amendment, the A5 amendment. Is there any further amendment to the bill?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative
Thacker. Yep. I would like to move forward the A2 amendment. Would ask the co-authors to consider it. The A2 amendment establishes a 7-day prescription limit for opioids when they are prescribed to acute pain. You know, as an EMT, I have picked up, unfortunately, several people in my 24 years volunteer who have OD'd on various items. And this is one of them. So what I think this does is allows a doctor to use their professional judgment to provide a longer prescription when necessary. And what's interesting is research shows that taking opioids for more than a few days greatly increases the risk of long-term use. We've heard testimonies this afternoon with that, which leads to addiction. And we saw unfortunately, some sad outcomes this afternoon with that addiction. The CDC has recommended doctors to prescribe these at a lower dose. CVS has self-imposed a prescription limit just like this. Other states are proposing even stricter limits. Many states have already acted and created their own limits. And, in fact, Minnesota already has limits on opioid prescription for dental pain and dental surgery. So we should follow those examples set by other states, and I would ask the authors here to me it seems like a common sense amendment, especially based on the testimonies that we heard this afternoon, and you guys know heard a whole lot more than I have. So that's what I have, Madam Chair. Thank you for your time.
Representative Olson, you have any comment on the A2 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Backer, I see that as a friendly amendment and would encourage all members to vote yes on this amendment. And so I look forward to your support of the bill.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Chair Liebling.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question about this, Representative Backer, how this works in practice. Since this allows a practitioner, and you know, and I think it's well intentioned, and you know, it may very well work. And I'm just kind of have a question about that. I, I know this has come up before. Maybe there's been testimony on it before, and I don't recall what that is. But I just wonder, you know, how would this work? Would physicians have to write something separate in their notes? Would they have to tell the pharmacist, I know it's only a 7-day supply, but I've decided in my professional judgment that it should be more? Or, you know, can you just kind of tell us what that would look like from the practitioner's side? I don't know if there's anybody here that could testify to that, but
actually, we do have a physician here.
Well, I was thinking more of like a, I mean, well, a physician could testify to it, I guess. But first, let me see if
Representative Backer.
Representative Backer has an answer. And I was thinking more of the MMA, but, you know.
Good question. Thank you, Representative. It works like the last time I had dental work, and actually my tooth was more infected than I wanted, and they put right on the sheet that I could go up to 3 prescription, you know, 3 refills per se. That's really how I see it. It's no different than when I bring a person to ER as an EMT, that doctor makes judgment calls and so forth. So, yes, we are giving the doctor that authority because they are the closest to that problem. So that's how I see it, just a simple, just a prescription, just like I've seen with my dental work and so forth. So that's how I see it following through.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I don't think you really answered my question, Representative Backer, because, I mean, it sort of sounds like, to me, like it doesn't really make any difference from the provider's point of view because they don't have to really, I mean, they're being told in statute, I mean, we know most people don't read the statutes, but they're being told that you should only give a 7-day supply in statute, which is, we don't usually in statute tell practitioners how to practice as a matter of, you know, our practice, but given that, maybe this is, should be an exception. I grant you that, but I'm just wondering, how is the physician going to know, and what is that going to look like from that practitioner's end? And I see Mr. Renner's here. Maybe, I don't know if he'd mind my calling on him to come and see if the MMA has an opinion on this, or if he has an idea how this would work from the point of view of the practitioner. And I'm not necessarily opposed to it. I just want to make sure that since this is a policy committee and we're making policy that impacts prescribers, that we understand what we're doing.
But please introduce yourself.
I was going to address the question. Yes, thank you. And you know, it's the same thing again. And I'm going to use my example as an EMT. A couple years ago, there was a law passed that saying an ambulance can run with a mutual service taking call for 12 hours. Same thing here. The profession's going to need to, you know, learn about it through DHS, and hopefully they follow it. But right now, from my perspective, this is, we need to take a step forward. We have people who are ODing on this and causing death, and we need to start forward. This has many, many channels if someone comes up with something better, but we need to start to have this because I've heard that, you know, through testimonies that many people OD'd. So it is a merit system. We're not going to have a drug cop at the ER or anything like that, but just like the seatbelt law, it was started as a suggestion and look at how many lives have been saved there. This is the same approach that we've seen in other situations. Good question. Thank you.
Mr. Renner, would like to speak today?
Madam Chair and members, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. And I appreciate the Representative Backer's amendment. When we have talked with the author, we've talked to others with this concept. Generally, to Representative Liebling's point, we agree we don't like putting into law how to practice medicine. We are comfortable with this language, however, for a couple of reasons. Number one, this is based on what we have already done with dental, as Representative Backer suggested. And it's very similar language where there is a kind of dose limit, but then there's professional judgment. So the way we look at this is more like a guideline. And this is a guideline just like, I think, as Representative Backer suggested, CDC has developed. I know we have worked on through ICSI and other groups that have developed guidelines. So how we would interpret this is that we would educate our members in saying the guideline is you should not be doing more than 7 days, But if there is reasons otherwise, you would clearly want to put that in your medical record and in the patient notes. The example that we hear all the time when we talk about these dose limits, something like a knee replacement, most people will say for a knee replacement, you may need more than seven because you want the patient to be able to do the rehab and the physical therapy. But clearly, the move among in medicine is to go shorter. Many physicians are now saying they're doing less than 3 days, and then see if we need more. But so we look at this as a guideline, and we're comfortable with this language.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Renner. So, I take it that your organization kind of views this as sort of a call on the organization to educate physicians that this is the direction that we want to go.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, yes, and Madam Chair, we have been doing that again through the CDC guidelines, through the ICSI guidelines, and trying to educate physicians that, you know, the good old days of 30-day doses doesn't make sense anymore. And as I say, many physicians are going down to 3 and 4 day maximums to start.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it, Madam Chair.
Representative Robbins, to the A2 amendment.
The A3.
A.
When
this is over, that's what I was trying to say. So, okay. So sorry. Okay. Okay. So, is there any further discussion? All right. So hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. And the amendment is adopted. All right. So, is there any further amendments?
Madam Chair, forgive me. I didn't realize that it had been part of the author's amendments that were adopted earlier today. So, forgive me. As a new freshman, I'm learning the ropes, but thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, any further discussion on the bill? Representative Schultz.
Madam Chair, I'd like to request a roll call vote, please. Okay.
So a roll call has been requested. So the chair has renewed her motion that House File 400, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Moran?
Yes.
Yes. Vice Chair Morrison?
Yes.
Minority Lead Keel? Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Backer?
Yes.
Representative Bonner?
Yes.
Representative Edelson?
Yes.
Representative Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler? Representative Mann? Representative New? Representative Pearson? Representative Pinto?
Yes.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Schultz?
Okay. There have been 10 ayes and 3 nays. The motion is adopted. So House File 400, as amended, is recommended and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
That concludes our business, and we are adjourned.